Hello, you're listening to Enemies of Good Art on Resonance 104.4 FM. Welcome, this is our first broadcast in the new series after a long summer break. Anna Shorter will be joining us next week from Berlin and will continue to contribute shows over the foreseeable future. Lisa Baritzter from the Department of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck University will produce a mini-series throughout the foreseeable weeks with her colleagues at MAMSE, an interdisciplinary research network based in the Department of Psychosocial Studies at Birkbeck University. And Esther Windsor, a researcher at Kingston University, will also produce a number of shows, and she's interested in areas around and ideas around emotional capital. I'm joined today by Verity Flecknell, if
That's
I pronounced
right,
that correctly,
yeah.
Who's the founder of Storm in a Teacup Collective, a feminist arts collective set up in 2009. To help promote female artists of all disciplines from the DIY / grassroots scene. Hannah Phillip is a graduate in politics from Glasgow University and the University of Oxford. Currently working in finance, she launched the East London Fawcett Group with Labour Party activist Rachel Blake in May of 2011, which is this year. And we are soon to be joined by Gemma Rowles-Bentley, who's flying down Borough High Street as we speak. She's an independent curator. She recently curated 400 Women, a conceptual installation by artist Tamsin Challenger that responds to gender violence in Mexico, and that showed at the Edinburgh Arts Festival. The title of today's show is East London Fawcett Group, and we'd like to promote the East London Fawcett Group for the great work that they have already started to do and are about to do. And East London Fawcett Group talks art. They have an event coming up on the 19th of October, which Hannah is going to talk a little bit more about in a minute.
Yeah.
But it's an evening of talks planned to generate considered campaigns that identify and address inequalities that women still face in all sectors of contemporary society. This, their first event, considers alarming statistics in relation to women and the art world. And first of all, I heard about East London Fawcett Group. Well, I hadn't known about them for a while, but Hannah contacted me because of this event and asked if Enemies of Good Art would participate.
Yeah.
And first of all, to begin with, Hannah, I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about East London Fawcett. You set it up in 2009. No, 11 this year.
Yes. it's very
but
new.
Set it up in May. Why and with whom?
Well, I set the group up with Rachel Blake, and we were put in contact with one another by the Fawcett Society. We were both members of the Fawcett Society living in East London. And we had tried to identify sort of local feminist group that we could get involved in so that we could basically support any activism that was going on locally to address gender inequality in the area. And since setting it up, we've now realised there are a fantastic bunch of feminist organisations in the area, but that weren't visible to us at the time. So we both contacted the Fawcett Society and asked if there was an East London group, and there was one, but it wasn't active. And they put us in touch with one another because we'd both contacted them with the same inquiry. Rachel and I met, immediately hit it off, realised that despite not being exactly the same age, we were roughly the same age, sort of similar generation, had similar background, and just both had the same self-assertion as feminists, sort of new generation of feminists, and we wanted to be involved as much as possible in promoting gender inequality and actively supporting campaigns that address inequality, and also trying to identify them. So that's it's been a long process, but we've sort of got a rough infrastructure now and a mailing list of women locally who've asked to be involved. So obviously, we've got the Fawcett brand behind us. And we work in coordination with the Fawcett Society, but we're very much a local group. Does that answer your question?
And why now?
Well, I think because I've only lived in London for a year, so I set it up 6 months after moving to East London. And I think I just really was sick of just watching things on TV, reading about sort of issues that women were facing, not necessarily women like myself. I would be the first to say I've been very fortunate and I myself feel quite empowered. But there are still, I'm aware, hundreds, thousands of women, obviously worldwide, but even just round the corner from me, that were facing problems because they were women. And instead of just being angry and shouting at the TV and sort of getting angry while watching Question Time or something, I decided I had to do something about this, and setting up an East London branch of the UK's leading lobby for gender inequality and trying to access these women who maybe are marginalised, who don't necessarily feel that empowered, who are struggling by themselves, give them, you know, make it be known that there is a group of women out there that are there to listen and support them and believe that there is still inequality, there is still a reason for feminism.
Mm. And Verité, you started Storm in a Teacup.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about and why?
Well, it was really a group of friends back in 2009. There was a number of reasons. One of them, we were artists ourselves, musicians, a mix of musicians and artists. And we had kind of become very disheartened by the music and art world, as, and we found it very hard to navigate our way around. We felt very alone as artists. And so we wanted to sort of create a supportive and nurturing community, and create a platform for these you know, female artists that weren't necessarily mainstream and were finding it hard to get a foot in the art world. What was the other reason? The other reason, I guess, was that we were very inspired by all the other groups that started to pop up everywhere. There was lots of sort of female-centric projects that were, I started to notice online. Projects like The Girls Are, which are a music blog site with sort of up-and-coming bands, female-fronted bands, and people like Underwire Festival, who are a film festival that promote sort of female filmmakers. So there were lots of sort of little projects that were happening, and we noticed that people weren't kind of talking to each other, and we wanted to try and encourage people to start working together, create a network, share contacts, support each other, and so that's where the idea came from, really. And we were just overwhelmed by the response, and it all started from there, really. Yeah.
Whenever I talk about this, and this isn't the first show that where we've talked about feminism, but we seem, you know, whenever the conversation comes up again, or the subject comes up around feminist activities and resurgence in activism and even thought and discussion and debate around women's issues, we're all so surprised.
Yeah, surprised by
the fact that we're talking about it, the fact that we need to.
Yes, absolutely. But this, I think, was another area in which Rachel and I connected, that we both felt very strongly that we're feminists. I mean, I would say sort of for quite a few years I've felt that I am a feminist, and that it's absolutely integral to my dignity as a person, not just as a woman, but as a person. But I maybe have been afraid to say that because they're still associated with things of the past and another generation. And I think there's a misconception that feminism, you know, died away in the 80s and 90s because it wasn't necessary anymore, because every battle had been won. But actually, it was that within the feminist movement itself, the different strands were unable to connect and unite together and create, you know, male and female force for change, and instead spent a lot of time focusing on what on being prescriptive on what they one group felt was right and another group felt a woman should be. You know, you can't be a feminist if you shave your legs, or you can't be a feminist if you have children, you can't be a feminist if you get married, and all these different things. And Rachel and I were just like, right, bottom line, we're feminists. Anybody can be a feminist. The important thing is that you recognise that you are. Sometimes I say something quite controversial, and I probably shouldn't say it on the radio, because I often hide from it myself, but I say, you know, you're either a feminist or you're a misogynist, basically. You either believe that women are equal or you don't.
It's a little bit like Bush's great diktat. You're either with us or against us.
I mean, that's prescriptive in itself, but it's not. It's more like from a conceptual perspective that I feel that. And if we're not afraid of doing that, if we recognise that there are maybe 40 organisations operating in East London that all have some kind of underlying feminist principles, why can't we unite together, address the biggest challenges facing women, and do something to change the way that we're living to make the lives of women better?
I'm always scared to sort of say I'm a feminist, even though I blatantly am. It's a very strange thing, really. But I think the change that's happened recently is that I think feminism has kind of been repackaged, and it's a lot more accessible. Whereas before, you might sort of imagine a butch lesbian throwing facts at you. It's become, I don't know, a lot more friendly and
definitely. And actually, the theme of our first, I completely agree with you, Verity, and that's why the theme of our launch wasn't sort of centred around anger or defence or reaction. It was a celebration. We decided it was a celebration of the fact that so many women identify themselves as feminists these days. There's so much being done every day by women and men to address the challenges that face women, and so we decided that it should be a celebration of the fact that we can use this word in the mainstream and, you know, live our lives as we would do anyway, but call ourselves feminists.
I should say, and excuse me, Cecily, I didn't introduce her. We're joined in the studio today by Cecily, who's nearly three, and at the moment we've got Toy Story on in the background. And Gemma has just walked in. And as a gentle introduction, we've just started to talk about the event that's coming up on the 19th of this month. And both Verité and Hannah were talking about why that has come about and their interest in it and why they've become involved. And I know you've just walked through the door and haven't had a chance to catch your breath.
That's okay.
But you're chairing the event on the 19th.
That's right, yep.
And your interest in that particular event with East London Faucet and Storm in a Teacup, you come from?
Well, I'm interested in both of the organisations anyway. I'm a member of the East London Faucet group and I've been to lots of Storm in a Teacup events. And the reason they invited me to chair the panel event next week is because I'm a curator and I've recently curated an exhibition, a feminist art, but I've also, prior to that, a lot of my research interests have touched on women's issues or have primarily focused on women's issues. So it seemed, even though I may not be as well established as other people that could have been invited, I think because I'm a member and I've been involved with both of the organisations and it's where my interests lie, it was an obvious choice.
There are some quite horrific statistics that you have drawn upon that I believe have come from the research that UK Feminista are currently engaged with, and some of them, to read them out, are 66% of women working behind the scenes in the music industry are men. 47% of women in the music industry earn less than £10,000 per annum, I presume.
Yeah, per annum.
83% of artists in the Tate Modern, and I presume that's in the collection, are men.
Yeah.
Ouch. 70% of artists in the Saatchi Gallery collection are men. Yeah. Or 70% of the artists represented, perhaps. 70% of the artists that have been nominated for the Turner Prize have been men, and only three women have ever won. Just 12% of the winners. The event on the 19th is very much looking at, it's called Art Talks. We don't want any more. And you're engaging with the art world. Why did you decide? I mean, for any event, you could have started off with your first event could have been on any subject. Could have been women in any working environment. Why did you choose the arts?
Well, I think first of all, it's because East London is a hive of creativity. There are a lot of women working in insecure jobs who work in creative industries in East London. And there are a lot of women of my age and who in theory have so many opportunities, but yet because they work in the art world, maybe they can't achieve the same sort of notoriety as men, maybe. Or we wouldn't, I don't want to say any more facts because I don't know outside of what UK Feminista said, but we just want to explore the reality of women who are working in the art world in East London. And the second reason was that this is an existing network that we already had through Verity. And so in future, we'd like to broach other subjects such as poverty and the environment. But it made sense to start with art because we could rely on Verity to sort of promote this event to as wide a pool as we possibly could right now in its early stages, the group.
Obviously, you've joined me on Enemies of Good Art, and we quite often, always, talk about issues surrounding the notions of practice, creative practice in its many forms, and how that fits in with subjects, questions, ideas around family and starting a family, or if not. And we've even had some shows where we've talked about artists. We talked with artists about their choices in terms of whether they have a family or not. You're all in your mid-20s and all engaged in feminist activities. Feel free to decline to answer if you so wish, because I am putting you all on the spot here. But questions around the family, do they concern you in your mid-20s?
I've started to think about family. I'm actually in a gay relationship, but I do want to have kids. And I've started to think about the next 5 years and how do I work towards that? And can I sustain the lifestyle I'm living right now in the future? And they're all big questions I can't answer. And it seems, you know, I'm trying to think about it, but I can't visualise how I'm going to do it. But I really want to have kids. I really do. And I'm scared it's going to happen too late. But I really do want, I do want a family and I do want to have kids. And it'd be interesting to see how I make it work.
Yeah, and I think it's something that's receiving a lot of attention at the moment. There seems to be a lot of articles and radio programmes that I've been coming across the last few weeks, seemingly spurred on by this stupid film, How Does She Do It? I've heard a couple of programmes on Radio 4, and even I think it was in Grazia magazine, there was an article about it. And the way it was posed on all of those things I found really terrifying. And it was the figures were interesting because it was saying a lot of women were making the decision not to have children, but the way it was posing it was that it really still is a decision that you have to make, a choice between career and family. And I certainly don't see it like that, and I know amongst my peer group that's not how anybody sees it. And I thought we'd reached a stage where people didn't see it as a straight cut choice. So I found it quite interesting that the press exploration of this topic has still seemed to present it in that way.
But Gemma, can I ask you a question? Because this is something I sometimes think, because we are in a position where we're not forced yet to think whether we want to have children or not, even though we probably all do consider it. But is it idealistic to think that there isn't some compromise that needs to be made, that you can have both?
Well, I definitely think there's always going to be some compromise if you decide to have both. But I don't think you have to sacrifice one thing entirely.
Yeah.
My career is hugely important to me, and I'm not in a relationship right now, but I certainly would like to have children. But I don't see that kind of in my next 10-year plan. And I turn 27 tomorrow, so I'm going to be nearly 40 when I have kids. But I'm quite happy with that.
I am nearly 40 and my heart is breaking here. I have lots to say on this subject. However, Hannah, how do you?
I think that there are always these ridiculous archetypes, such as portrayed in this new film. I haven't seen the film. I don't think I can bear to watch it. When I read about it, you know, that we face, which just don't even address the issue. Like, it's almost like an internal challenge or an individual challenge that you have to face. Can you be superwoman and have a child and have a career? And I don't know, the women, because I do have friends that have children, and the women that I face, inevitably, even if to them they're not making a sacrifice, it's perceived as a sacrifice. So they're either seen as bad mothers because they work full time when they have a 2-year-old child, or they're seen as letting this feminist side down because they've decided to give up work for 5 years in order to have 2 kids in succession, or things like this. And it's still these really prescriptive like ideas. And I just hope that when it comes to me making the decision, I'll be able to make a free decision that I feel is right for me, and follow my instincts, I suppose. I absolutely want children, but I also know that I don't want to feel constrained either in my career or by having a child, that I can't do things that I know I am capable of, or that I'll be judged, I suppose. What do you think?
I'm kind of, when you take an objective point of view, I'm shocked that we even have to like consider this. It's a natural thing. Like, you know, there's a long way for society to well, it's around the corner, but we do need to work on, you know, making it easier for people to make that decision. And it is a really tough one.
So how do women of your generation, because I've had my baby, I'm having the fight, the discussion, this is why we're here, but where do women of your generation, are we a generation apart? We're not. We're just over 10 years. But where do you know, women in their 20s, how do they pick up the baton in terms of making it more possible somehow? You know, what do you know what you might need to change for things to be better for you? Yes, of course, I in my mid-20s thought there's no way till I'm 35. And I had her at 36.
Yeah.
And I feel very differently now. If I could have, if with hindsight, if I could go back, yes, I would have got my shit together a lot earlier. And I would perhaps have taken the risk. I'm not telling you this is what you should do. Mm-hmm. But I would perhaps have dived in, because
earlier,
you can always pick it up again.
Mm. Yeah.
So, but is the desire to fully establish one's career and also living in London, you know, provide yourself with a stable home? Presumably.
Yeah, definitely. I think it doesn't just come down to career. I think it, you know, comes down to just other sort of lifestyle
financial
choices,
security, yeah,
and that kind of thing. And I'm sure that if, you know, as we were to have children now, there were a lot, you know, our career wouldn't have to suffer immediately, and we could, like you say, pick it back up. But I think there's perhaps, you know, luxuries that we enjoy right now that we're not necessarily prepared to sacrifice, as well as the career question.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we lead quite full lives in terms of our access to fun and culture and other people, you know, and meeting people
and traveling
and activism and traveling and all these things. And it's those things maybe that we're more afraid of, being young and with so many opportunities. And
I guess working in the arts as well, maybe freelancing or doing something voluntarily, you won't have the time. Like for me, it's in my own time, it's after work, I put all my energy into storming a teacup. You know, I won't have the time to do all the things I want to do. And I don't know, it's also the job market really, isn't it? There's lots of freelancers and people involved in, you know, the art world. And will there be a job for you when you've had a kid and you want to go back to things, you know, because it's building up your career and building up your reputation and then just dropping it. That's what I'm scared of. And
but you work in a very precarious manner, no? There's, I mean, your income, probably like mine, comes from a number of different sources.
Well, I work a full-time job,
job,
so I'm okay there. But yeah.
Okay, I'm currently engaged to the group that kind of operate out of East London right now, but it's not East London centric, essentially. It's called the Precarious Workers Brigade. And they're a very active group. And they are running a series of campaigns
with cultural workers, because they don't want to just keep it to one particular sector of the cultural scene, where they talk about internships a lot and campaign against the notion of free internships, among other things. Their campaigns are quite wide, but that idea of precarity and how it affects us surely has to in some way then impinge upon the decisions we make. I mean, mm-hmm. I know that, Hannah, you're not in the job that you want to be in. And do we stay in jobs for life anymore? I mean, in terms of career, in terms of... I know, I'm going to get you in trouble at work now.
No, you're not going to get me in trouble at work. In terms of my lifelong...
Ambitions.
Ambitions, yeah. I think it's more in terms of control over your own working hours. I couldn't have a child now in the job I do. Hmm. I think that's what the point is. And so when you talk about precarious working hours, on the flip side, if you work a full-time job, I'm not sure I could take, say, if I decided to have a child now, which I'm not going to do, I could take maternity leave necessarily and then return to the job in the same capacity. I have to be at my desk 5 days a week. I have to be working within a team. There isn't so much flexibility. My company is fantastic in terms of how it promotes women and supports women and offers the best flexibility for women. But at the same time, there are just certain jobs that you can't do. And so, well, you talk about precarity. Sometimes I think I would be envious of people with more precarious work, where they have greater control over their working hours and when they want to work, and they can take time out for their child. They can choose when they're making art and not. And I know it's not as simple as that, but I just mean it's not, you know, it's not up to an employer necessarily directly that controls your working pattern.
But then at the same time, you have to be able, if you are working in a precarious manner, you've got to make sure it pays, and without the consistency, you know, it's a real nightmare. Well, 6 months ago, made a change from working freelance to working full-time job, and doing the full-time job, which, you know, is perfect for me right now. It also allows me to curate, which I do on the side, and I was working on, you know, I've been working on the same projects I was working on when I was freelancing, but I didn't have the financial stability, and so I wasn't able to achieve as much. Even though now my time is even more limited, I'm allowed a different kind of freedom within sort of my working structure, because I know that I don't have to worry about my finances in the same way. So I can take on extra projects where there's little or no pay and it comes much later and that kind of thing. But I think as well, for women making art, something I really want to bring up is, because I looked it up this afternoon, because this week in terms of visual art is such a massive week with Frieze happening and the contemporary art sales and things, which is a sphere I work in. I just out of interest had a look through the Sotheby's catalogue to have a look, because obviously for women who are making art and working in a freelance manner, they need to know they can sell their art, otherwise they have no income. And I had a look and I was so appalled that I wrote it down because I wanted to discuss it on here. There are, out of the Sotheby's Contemporary Sale catalogue, there are 186 lots. 18 of those are artworks made by women. Mm-hmm. And the Contemporary Sale is split up into an evening and a day sale, and the evening sale is the much higher valued artworks, and there are 47 lots in that, and only 4 of those are made by women. So not only are women severely underrepresented in this, they're not even, you know, equally shared between the high valued artwork. And I just couldn't believe it. I'd been reading a few essays a week or two ago, and the figures from there were from 2005, and they were bad, but actually I think these ones are worse. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I expected to read this 6 years, have a look 6 years later and see some improvement, and I actually think there's a decline, and I was so dismayed.
That's horrendous.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Why do we think this is the case? I mean, do you have any opinion about why this might be?
Well, I think in terms of artwork being valued and collectible, it's to a large extent a direct reflection of what is perceived to be valued, i.e. what is included in museums and galleries and what is displayed and what is brought into collections. And because I think collectors, when they're buying artwork, the provenance makes a huge difference to how they see the value of the artwork. And so if they don't see these works made by women being exhibited in museums, it in their head doesn't value as highly. And the figures that you read out at the beginning about that 83% of the artists in the Tate Modern are men, you know, that's going to make people, without probably processing the thought in their head, just think, well, it's the men that are making the best art and that's what fetches the most money. So I think that's why people pay more and that's why it goes into the sales. And that's obvious. So I think the changes have to come from the museum directors and the curators. I feel a sense of responsibility as a curator that I would want to make sure I was giving the same opportunities to women as to men in work I was displaying. And actually, I think it would make me want to go actively seek the opportunities to display art made by women.
Your show in Scotland at the Edinburgh Arts Festival, how was that received?
It was really great. It was an exhibition by an artist called Tamsin Challenger called 400 Women, and it's an installation of 200 or thereabouts portraits of women who have gone missing or have been murdered in the border towns in Mexico. And the art, and each of these portraits is made by a different artist, and it's a mixture of male and female artists. And it's an incredibly powerful exhibition, and it was exhibited at the end of last year in London, in Shoreditch Town Hall basement, and then we took it to Edinburgh Art Festival, and it was received really, really well. People were still visiting it in the last few days when it wasn't actually, the art festival wasn't on anymore, and, you know, it was word of mouth, and we got some really great press, and I think people thought that it was a really important exhibition and an important project, which I did, which was, you know, why we took it there. Mm-hmm. And I think people found the topic that it was discussing really important, and a lot of people didn't know very much about it. So in terms of awareness raising, it was really a big success as well.
There's a lot of activity, a lot of feminist activity, and we can talk, there's a lot of political activity taking place in London at the moment. It's a hotbed for all sorts of great work that's taking place. And do we put it down to the recession or economic climate at the moment that women are beginning to reassess and reevaluate their our positions? Are there other reasons why we think that the conversation earlier, you know, am I a feminist? Can I call myself a feminist and how I feel like that is
I think people are sort of wanting to work together, and there's a more of a community aspect to the way, you know, people get approach projects. And I think it has encouraged people to get up and do things for themselves, not wait for someone to come and do it for them, not wait for the money to come in before they do something, but just to get up and use the contacts and the networks they have to do great things. So I definitely think it's empowered people to be active and to get involved with things and to feel part of something.
I know that you have quite a large network. Mm. How did that network develop for you?
Online, mainly, actually. So, we launched in 2009, and a lot of the activity we had was on our Facebook and our blog site. And I guess it was easy for people to participate because everything's online. You feel like you're part of it, even if you click like on something or you repost one of our posts. People feel involved. So I think it's the participatory kind of aspect that people...
This is Storm in a Teacup we're talking about.
Yeah. We have things like open submissions for events that we have, so anyone can submit to our exhibitions, and so it's kind of that community aspect. People I think are waking up to a bit more And sort of they want to do things for themselves. So,
do you have any men in the group?
A few, yes. We have lots of men that come to our events. And I guess another different thing with Storm in a Teacup as well is, I guess feminist arts and the queer arts as well are very intermingled. And I guess what we kind of did was we repackaged that and kind of made it accessible to straight women, bi women, queer women, and so our events are kind of open to all. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another thing that we did very different that was very successful and really sort of caught people's attention. And yeah.
The three of you here are engaged in the event coming up on the 19th. Mm-hmm. It's at Margaret's Hall?
Yes, Margaret's House, the hall in St Margaret's House above the Gallery Cafe in Bethnal Green.
Okay, that's on Old Ford Road, just beside York Hall. Yep. And opposite the Museum of Childhood, for anyone who's interested in attending.
Yeah, and it's free and open to everybody.
And what are you hoping, Hannah, is going to come out of this particular event?
Well, Rachel and I were originally, when we decided what form the group would take, we wanted fundamentally for it to be very open, and so we didn't want to exclude anybody from it. We wanted it to be a forum for open debate, and a campaigning group driving change for women in East London. So we wanted to obviously make a difference. And also a learning group to inform each other about the issues that are affecting other women and try and cross some of the class and racial boundaries that exist in East London. I mean, that's an absolutely enormous challenge. Mm. But we want to at least be aware that that challenge exists and try and do something about it. So we thought if we organise the group around talks and we try and promote the talks via different channels, contact different groups, and then form a panel maybe of just two women or up to five women or however many, and men as well, if necessary, of people that can inspire the attendees to the talk, and also from whom we can learn something. And these women could either be sort of nationwide kind of well-known or just women from the local area, of which you are one, Martina, on the 19th.
I am a local Bethnal Green girl.
Yeah. No, I mean, you will be sitting on the panel on the 19th.
I will.
Then maybe we can all decide together what we should be campaigning on. Because Rachel and I don't necessarily want to make that decision, but instead listen to our diverse group when we're deciding that. So ultimately, we'd hope to identify what the top or the most pressing challenges are that face women in the arts in East London, and also how we can go about campaigning for this. And if we invite other local groups, then hopefully they'll take this on board and we'll create more of a union, as it were, to act together rather than kind of as separate groups maybe competing against each other. Although I can't imagine that right now, but I'm sure that's possible.
How much contact do you have with the other Fawcett groups around London?
Well, Rachel and I, before we set up the East London group, we attended a meeting of the South London group, from whom we learnt a bit about how we could organise, also maybe how we wanted to be different. And I mean, I suppose, yeah, we were learning from them. So we do have contact with them, and they're on our mailing list. We tell them about everything that's going on. We would absolutely support them if they asked us to publicise something or attend an event. As for other groups, we haven't had contact with any yet, but we sort of contact the Fawcett Society on a regular basis, meet up with the central team, and kind of go through them and have everything sort of conducted in coordination with them. For example, we drafted a manifesto because we decided we needed to have a kind of loose outline. We organised some meetings that were open to anybody that wanted to participate in drafting this, and we had it sort of approved by the Fawcett Society to make sure that it wasn't going to be contradicting any activity that they were currently undertaking. Mm-hmm. So we do work in coordination as much as possible. We definitely don't have any fixed ideas of working independently.
It's interesting how all these sort of trendy WI groups are popping up as well. Like, you've got the Shoreditch Sisters and
the Dalston Darlings.
Yeah. The Shoreditch Sisters are doing something quite interesting at the moment, actually, working with Dana Jade, who's organising this day festival called Clit Rock, which is raising awareness about female genital mutilation. And it's kind of like a day of an evening of female-fronted bands, and the Shoreditch Sisters are involved in that as well. So, yeah, there's lots of... Actually, when is that? Better plug it probably.
November 20th, isn't it?
November the 20th at the Lexington. So, yeah.
The Shoreditch Sisters and the Dalston Darlings.
Yeah. Yes, the Dalston Darlings, who I haven't had the pleasure of meeting yet, but very excited to. Hopefully they will attend the talk next Wednesday. And what I think is really great, which is almost bigger than feminism, is just the idea that, you know, if people work together, you're going to have so much more of an impact, obviously. But if, you know, I think there's few people that if you talked about female genital mutilation with wouldn't agree that they would want to do something about this and change it. And so if you can use your position of empowerment or with a big mailing list or with a voice within an organisation, or if you have money and you can organise something, or if you're a musician and you can sing about something, or you're a writer, you can write about something, then you should sort of do that. And I think that's at the basis of what we're all doing.
It doesn't it seem like there's just so much work to be done?
Yeah, yes. I definitely think we have a long way to come. I mean, just for me, comparing those figures 6 years apart about women artists being included in auctions, I could not believe that nothing had improved in six years, you know. And it's really difficult as well, because I think a lot of it is down to changing attitudes. You know, you meet people all the time that say, oh, well, we in the West, we have it good now. We've achieved equality, which, of course, is really shocking and terrifying when you hear people say that. And I think these events that the girls have just been discussing are the perfect way to do it, because you can do it through several ways. You can show people these figures and explain things and give them numbers and things that they can actually get their head around. But then you can also, through the social events and the music and everything that we've been talking about and the exhibitions and things, just spur on and some kind of enthusiasm and get people excited and motivated toward achieving these goals. And I think as long as these events continue to happen and more people attend them, then I think, you know, we're getting further towards our collective goal. But I agree, we have a really long way to go.
Yeah, but if we're not doing something about it, even if we're not changing anything right now, I mean, the figures that you read out, Gemma, like, what hope does that give to young female artists? Mm. But if they can see visibly other women and men working towards changing that, then that's the hope that they can have.
Definitely.
So that can provide hope for them as an artist and give them inspiration to carry on doing what they're doing, even if they're not recognised yet by the industry.
I think we need more role models, and that's what I like to think we're trying to do here. We're trying to inspire sort of new future leaders in the arts, you know. When I first came to London when I was 18, went to uni, there wasn't a scene here for me, and I kind of, when I came back to London again, maybe after uni, after a few years after I finished uni, I came back to London. I was like, where, it still isn't anything here. So that's why we created our own culture. But then there's also the argument about creating your own space. You know, is that going to change anything by creating a women only space?
When you say creating your own culture, what group essentially are you talking about?
Scene, as in creating our own scene, bringing people together and creating our own networks.
And all the different groups. I mean, it's like Verity and I were just talking. There's despite how engaged we are, and Gemma is, like, in this subject, we still aren't aware of all the groups that are working towards change. And if only we could become more aware, which is ultimately what we're trying to do, by organising different events, inviting everybody, being very open, providing contact details all the time, and, you know, coming on the radio and talking about it, then we can create a bigger movement together, essentially. Because I just, I didn't know about so many of the groups that were already in existence, which is why Rachel and I set this up. Mm. We didn't think there was a feminist group in East London, and now I know that there's about 40, at least.
Yeah, and it's about utilising the tools that are available to us as well, because I started following Storm in a Teacup years ago when you were starting doing those events at the Victoria in Mile End, and I only knew about that because of Facebook. I had no idea who you were and or any of the other girls involved. So I just think even if the individuals with the initial idea don't know how to market it effectively, I think we need to share the skills that are there and just try and promote it through all these different channels.
Definitely.
And the internet is obviously a major one.
No, I was just going to say that I just wanted to take this opportunity to plug an event coming up at the Fawcett Society that is actually going to unite a number of groups across London and the UK, which is the Fawcett Society Day of Action on Saturday, the 19th of November. And it's essentially a campaign against certain decisions that the government are making that would turn back time on a lot of the progress that has been made towards gender equality. For example, cutting the current budget deficit will impact on female unemployment as jobs are cut in public services, benefits and services that women rely on are being slashed, women on low incomes are becoming poorer, the pay gap looks like it's going to widen, women's access to vital support services is being undermined, health services and so on, and increasing numbers of women are being forced to give up work as cuts to childcare support means that their jobs are no longer going to cover families' basic care costs. And I mean, this is just, like, unbelievable, I think, to us, that, you know, we're sitting here wanting to take, we're wanting to work together and identify ways that society can move forward, and we're doing it against, you know, a plethora of government decisions that are actually turning back time on women. And so that's Saturday the 19th of November, and people are going to be congregating at Temple Tube on Victoria, by Temple Tube on Victoria Embankment at 12 noon on the day. Dressed in 1950s dress to highlight the fact that perhaps we're all going to be have to be 1950s housewives again.
And where are the men to support us?
Hopefully alongside.
Hopefully at Temple Tube.
Hopefully at Temple
12
Tube.
O'clock.
They won't be.
Wearing a penny.
They will not be.
And curlers in the hair.
They will not be. And I have a little bit of a beef about this. You know, I'm not entirely convinced that the question of when to have children, and we have to be self-sufficient to a degree in terms of our careers and also securing housing for ourselves, whether it be through the social network or whether it be through your own economic means. But at what point do men then want to have children? I spoke to somebody not so long ago, a male, thinking, you know, his mid-30s is far too early. Then you need to meet a girl who's 10 years younger than you, I think, if you want to, you know, have children at the time that's right for you. But do we expect then, you know, who's going to help us then? If the state doesn't, because we're now about to be crucified to a degree by the state and through this new, through the plans that the government are making. If the state won't support us, are we then dependent upon men to support us? Because the business of having children means that at some point somebody has to support you, unless you're completely, unless you work in the city and you earn an awful lot of money and you can, you know, get a good deal for yourself when you go on maternity leave. Who then do we, are we as women, as feminists, not open to the possibility that we'd be supported by men anymore?
I think that's an important question to maybe ask Verity and Gemma, particularly Verity being in a long-term gay relationship, because there's no man in sight to support you.
That's why I can't really answer the question.
Well, Thanks, Hannah. I was just about to say, actually, I think a lot of the time, if you're thinking about having children, you're going to be looking for support. And if you're in a relationship, you know, that means you're teaming up and you're doing it together. It doesn't necessarily have to be a man. But also, I think if you decide... I don't think it comes just down to gender in this question. I think if...
I am generalising, and the vast majority of the public are in heterosexual situations.
But I'm thinking also about single parents who may get support from their parents or their friends or something. I don't think it always necessarily has to be falling, you know, back onto a man to give you the support.
No, but I think I can appreciate somewhat what you're saying, Martina, because I did some research last year at university for my master's into sort of models of social models of childcare and how that impacts on women's choices, fertility choices. And I was basically comparing Russia to sort of developed countries in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at kind of decisions that employers made in the labour market, government provision, and domestic decisions that were made at home or patterns of domestic behaviour at home. And to summarise, I sort of identified that it was the domestic decisions that had the biggest impact on women's fertility choices. So more so than what the government provided and employers provided, which were also much faster to change. It was cultural perceptions of how women should bring up children, when they should have children, how labour should be divided between partners, or, as Gemma mentioned, maybe we need to look beyond that to other kind of models of having children, and to look to friends and family for support, which I know women do, but it ultimately came down to women were put off having children because they knew that even if they could find support from their employer and from the government and from the state, they wouldn't be able to find it from their husbands or partners. And so they didn't want to have a child. They knew that they would end up bearing the sole domestic responsibility for a child, which I know that sort of you've had experience of.
That's perfectly fine. I exposed you earlier. You can expose me. You can expose me now. Yes, I have. I have. And I find myself being a single mother in the very difficult position where I'm not economically poor enough to be able to go to the state for help, but I'm not wealthy enough to be able to independently support myself. So in effect, because of my situation, and I plan on doing a show about this, which is around housing, and let me tell you that... if your name is on a mortgage, you can't get housing of any make, shape or description. But
you're in no man's land.
You're in no man's land. And effectively, you cannot get out of the relationship. Economically, financially, you cannot get out of the relationship. Not until the division of property has happened. So if the situation is that you find yourself incapable of living in the... or not, the situation is not conducive towards... or it's not harmonious anymore, shall we say, and you can't live in the property. If you decide to leave, you go on your own until that property is legally divided in whatever form that takes, depending on whether you're married or not. If you're married, then you have certain rights over the property. If you're not married, you leave with what you came with, which in the situation, which is my situation and for many women, is bugger all. So when I talk about ideas around support, there's a lot of information I didn't have before I became a mother that I wish I'd informed myself about, but then I didn't need to because, you know, I was too busy thinking that I was going to make art while the sun shone, and I would never need all these support systems. And of course, it hit me like a ton of bricks when I had my little girl. But of course, it puts men in a difficult position then, because if we're not earning enough as women, and Gemma, you must be coming across a lot of younger female artists who are equally as talented and capable of making great works of art. But, you know, what happens then around the years when they want to have a family?
Well, yeah, definitely I am. And I think, like we were discussing, the often precarious nature of of being an artist, it's really important to remain engaged with the scene and the people that can offer support and opportunities, be that galleries, public funding bodies or other institutions, that kind of thing. It's really important to stay on people's radar and to maintain a presence. And I think for a lot of women, when they become a mother and it's required for them to take some time off and for their art not to be the sole focus, or not even making the art, but that what goes with it in terms of sort of personal brand management and marketing your art as a separate thing or an additional thing, I think that causes massive problems when that bit of it has to be sacrificed, definitely. Mm. And because I think a lot of women miss that one big opportunity that they maybe needed because they've slipped off people's radar, or they, you know, haven't been able to be as forceful and put their art in front of as many people's eyes for such an extended continuous period of time.
And it's interesting that for most careers, it's, you know, the people are either on the cusp of establishing, you know, practices around their mid-30s, when it's just the time when you have to make the decision to have a baby or not. Mm. Because by the time you're hitting your 40s, and please don't wait till you're nearly 40, then biologically it may be more difficult for you to do so. And this is a difficult position for women to be in, you know.
In an ideal world, what would you propose would be the answer?
Oh, leave art school at 22 and have your babies.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I mean, in terms of what provision would you like to see?
I'm just going straight for the juggler there, aren't I? In terms of provision, we pay the highest rate of childcare anywhere in the world. This was on BBC Breakfast News. If it hits BBC Breakfast News, it has to be bad. Yeah. But the highest rate of childcare anywhere in the world, above New York, above, you know, anywhere in the world. I'm looking at three women in the room who are in their mid-20s who haven't had children yet. And of course, I don't really want to be saying this. Is it? Is it? Well, I might have to bribe her with some sweets in a minute. But anyway, we've only got about 4 minutes left. So there has to be, you know, those financial burdens in terms of childcare somehow has to become more manageable for women. And it's, you know, 93% of women still burden the responsibility of childcare in this country. So it's a feminist issue. And And so for women to go back to work, you know, I'm full of anecdotes in terms of women who work full-time jobs and at the end of it have a few hundred quid left by the time they've paid for the childcare. Yeah. Because if you sit in that bracket, that middle income bracket where your partner's earning, you're earning, you don't get the tax credits and the child tax credits to help with childcare. And the government have just lowered the threshold on that. So therefore, one salary goes towards childcare. And if you don't maintain your career, you don't have one to return to once your child goes to school at the age of five. So, I mean, I've tried all sorts of possibilities in terms of swapping, you know, child swapping, entering pools where we take care of each other's kids. It hasn't really worked. But it's not, you know, it's not possible. It is possible. I just didn't manage to achieve it. I don't want to hog the last few minutes, but that is my very strong opinion, and I could talk for another hour on that one. On my own, I'll have a monologue one evening.
Maybe we'll get a bottle of wine after and continue.
We can, yeah. But we have got a small child in tow. Yeah. However, I want to thank the three of you for coming on, and I'm really looking forward to the event next week. So for anyone who's in the area, if they want to get in touch, do we have email addresses that we'd like to hand?
Yes,
we'd like to give
absolutely.
Out?
So it's East London Fawcett, that's fawcett@gmail.com. And you can email about absolutely anything related to the group or the Fawcett Society. And also to reserve a place at the event, which, as we said, is going to be from 6 to 8 p.m. on the 19th of October at St. Margaret's House in the hall above the Gallery Cafe in Bethnal Green on Old Ford Road. And look forward to seeing you all then.
Okay, and Storm and a Teacup have a site or a blog?
Yes, we are www.joinourteaparty.org.
And Gemma will be hosting the event on the 19th. So thank you very much, Hannah, Gemma and Verité, Cecily and Marcus for engineering for us.
Thank you, Martina. Yes.